Well, all the bumper music I'm playing tonight, most of those singers are all dead. They're on the other side, too. Our special guest tonight, Rich Martini, and we'll take your calls and stories when we come back on Coast to Coast AM. Welcome back to Coast, Rich Martini with us. Rich, you were talking about the other side and, you know, whether you'd want to come back or stay. I'll let you finish that up.
Oh, that's a good point. Well, it's interesting because what the reports say is that it's a personal choice. So if someone comes to you and says, I want you to come back and play the role of my dad or my angry uncle or my alcoholic friend, you have the choice to say, no, I'm not going to do that, or I feel comfortable over here. However, as one spirit guide explained to me in one of the sessions that I was filming, he said, imagine a giant canvas that's blank. And when I sit together with the soul that I'm going to watch over all their lifetimes, think of each lifetime as paint that goes on the canvas. And that at the end of all their lifetimes, there's going to be this magnificent portrait. But when he got to the end of all of his lifetimes, that his graduation gift was me. So he became a guide after all of his lifetimes. And then he participated in all of my lifetimes. There was one event that he actually joined me here, according to him. So think of it in terms of class. You graduate from class, and now you're back in the flip side. You're with your friends. And, gee, what fun it is over here. I mean, it is really fantastic. So when your friends get together and say, George, would you like to come back with us? You can't say no, but, you know, what are you going to do back there without them?
But we've got free will, right?
That's right. Well, here's the other part of it. They say that two-thirds of us are always back there. This is roughly when you ask people under deep hypnosis how much of your energy did you bring here. Generally, they say about a third, somewhere between 20 and 40%. So two-thirds of your energy is already back there in the between lives realm, going to class, taking classes, teaching, learning, doing all kinds of interesting and unusual things. So this is the stage. And when you get off stage and you get back and reconnect with yourself and your friend, of course, you're going to sit around and say, I could have done better in this one area.
Yeah.
You know, let me try it again. What the heck? But that's true. It's reported that there's free will. So no one's forced to come back. You know, karma is something that has been a term that was used. It means action in Sanskrit, but it was used to almost include sin, you know, because based on karma, you were forced to come back. And, the Buddhist and the Hindu idea is that you get a lesser lifetime if you were bad. And, you know, you get a higher lifetime if you're good. Well, that's just not in the research. People choose their lifetimes. So now follow that through. The wiser, older souls choose the more difficult lifetimes. The people that the homeless guy that you meet on the street, when you see him now, think for a moment. It's possible that he chose this more difficult lifetime because he's an older, wiser person, and he chose it because he's going to teach compassion or love or acceptance to somebody somewhere along his path. It's a difficult choice, but it's one you can honor. There's a fascinating thing in a session that I filmed with a film producers, a jaded skeptic, who said, you know, I don't think I can be hypnotized, and I don't think there's a flip side, however, I will check it out. And so in this session, one of her questions she asked was, what or who is God? You know, if I'm going to get somewhere and I'm going to talk to somebody, well, I want to know, who's God?
I don't know if there's an answer for that.
Well, it was a fascinating answer from her spirit guide. Spirit guide said, God is beyond the capacity of the human brain to comprehend. It's just not physically possible. And the way he said it, I thought, oh, yeah, you know, like a computer, too much information. You can't process it. It's just too much for the human brain, is what he said, the human brain to comprehend. But he said, however, you can experience God. And in that moment, I realized, oh, yes, you know, like if you're talking to someone who grew up in the desert and you say, here's what a swimming pool is like, you know, they have no idea. But if you jump into a pool, then they experience it and then they know it. So when he said that, you can experience God. And then he said, The way to experience God is to open your heart to everyone and to all things. And in that moment, I realized, oh, you know, the bumper sticker, God is love. Well, it should be flipped. Love, or the concept that we can agree that love is, that's what God is. This thing that people report in near-death experiences of feeling an unconditional love. You know, when you examine that term, what is conditional love? Well, you know, people, you'll like something, you know, something on TV, something the remote control allows you to like for a little bit. Unconditional love is that thing where the guy pointing the gun at you, you love him as well. The guy who cut you off in traffic, you love them as well. The person who stepped on your toe repeatedly, you can love them as well because you've opened your heart to everyone. And then he added, into all things. And it made me realize, of course, you know, all the things that are on the planet, we consider trees to be things. Well, I consider trees to be lungs. They look like lungs. They function like lungs. We don't consider them lungs. We just consider them trees, things that we use for paper.
What they breathe and emit.
As my kid once said, you know, what, if people depend upon trees to breathe, why would you ever cut one down?
That's exactly right. He's right.
So profound. But when you start to think of things that exist on the planet that have their right to exist, they belong here, they're all part of this, you know, hoax, part of this simulation, part of this thing that we're experiencing together. And then it makes me realize, wow, if that's true, what they're saying, that everything is connected, then why would we ever pollute the air we breathe or pollute the land or pollute the water, especially if we're going to come back to enjoy it? Forget about the kids. You're going to come back and enjoy it. Wouldn't you want to come back and have a fresh glass of water?
Absolutely. Why does it seem, though, that the older we get, the more obsessed we are with finding out these answers about the afterlife?
Well, that's a great question. And somebody was saying this the other day about human behavior. We were just talking about how the older we get, it seems like the weirdness that we've always had, you know, the kind of strangeness, it seems to become larger. You know, so your friends that when you were in high school, they all kind of hoarded things, you know, in their desk. And now here they are and later in life, they're hoarding, you know, tons of stuff.
Or their lockers, open up their locker and everything falls
out. Their locker, and, you know, fastidious people. And then now cut to 40, 50, 60 years later, you know, they're crazy with that kind of stuff. But it's like our, you know, that's part of who we are as animals, of course. We're here as a physical creature. And we do, you know, have a beginning, middle, and an end as a physical creature. But as a spirit, we don't have that. We have a beginning, middle, and a graduation, apparently, is what they say. So we do have that path and that journey. It's just that what I find fascinating is how much people are talking about this now than they did 10 years ago or even 20 years ago. To me, it's this revelation of, well, the fact that I can be talking to you about it right now, it's unbelievable to me, you know, that you and I could meet on the planet and that we could, you know, I came to Boulder and talked to you on your show. That's so amazing that we could be in the same space on this planet.
You did a great job for us there.
Oh, well, thank you. But I mean, it's you. You're the person who opened the door for your guests to talk about stuff that people don't talk about. And I think it's high time we allow us to talk about this, at least to get a common syntax to say, you know what? My dad came to visit me last night, and I don't feel ashamed to tell you that it was like my dad was in the room. You see? I think
let's go to the phones for you, Rich. They're lining up. Let's go west. Lynn is with us in Spokane, Washington. Hi, Lynn. You're on the air.
Hello, George. I'd like to ask Richard, in all of his research, he was talking about people mostly meeting relatives when they talk about their afterlife experience. Mm-hmm. But I wanted to know if he had met anybody who talked about in the afterlife meeting other people besides their relatives, and in particular about gay relationships. maybe meeting your boyfriend or something that you've been really happy with in your life more than anybody else, and you prefer to meet them more than even your relatives.
Sure, absolutely. And Lynn, I got to tell you, I mean, we have a tendency to see our family, it's our soul group on the planet, you know, our relatives and stuff like that. And that's generally not the case in the research. Generally, the people that you meet in your soul group, according to this many cases, are not usually your family. They're usually people that you feel connected to. I'll give you one example. There was a fellow who had been outed by his religion, and he'd lost his job and his family because he was gay. And he went to see a hypnotherapist because he was so furious about, you know, choosing a lifetime that was so difficult. And in his between life experience, he saw that the man who had outed him, that part of the church that had outed him, was his spirit guide. And the spirit guide said, "Don't you remember? This was our agreement. You and I have been in so many different lifetimes where we were in the cloth. We were priests and nuns, and we were all these different things, and you wanted to experience life in its fullest. You wanted to fall in love, finally. And this was our way so that you could go and experience life in its fullest." And in that moment, he forgave everyone who had offended him, his family, etc., etc. So, yes, you find in the between-life realm, or after you die, according to what people say, that your loved ones, whoever they are, they're there. And sometimes you meet people who you think are not your loved ones. They're people who put the stone in your path, and it turns out you asked them to put the stone in your path. The person who had a dramatic effect on your life, maybe negatively, but then you realize, oh, I asked you to do that so that would allow me to get to this other place so I could learn something from that difficulty.
Rich, I haven't heard you talk about the evil side of all of this. How come?
Well, generally, unfortunately, it's not in the data. What, you know, even Alexander mentioned it, other people mention it, when they have their near-death experience or when they have these between-life sessions where they go back to their home, they don't find evil to be there. Here on the planet, of course, we live in a polarity, you know, good, bad, yin-yang. Once you're outside of time, once you're outside of the physical parameters of this yin-yang thing that we live in, you don't find evil per se, that concept. You find people who behave a certain way, either because you ask them to, and in many cases, some cases, people who are, they've had a journey and over many lifetimes, they just keep screwing up. And when they get back there, of course, they experience all the negativity they've engendered through a life review. They experience all the pain. It's like a hell that they have to suffer through. And in some rare cases, and I've even met somebody who said that during their between-life session, they said, you know, they remembered that they had been given this option to either be in a sort of a dark dungeon-like place where they examine their lifetimes, or they would be rebooted. And in this particular case, this guy said he couldn't access any lifetime before the rebooting, but so he didn't know what he had done that was so terrible, but they had reassembled his energy. I know that sounds really crazy, but I'm just talking about the research and what people say. So in terms of evil, in terms of Satan, he just doesn't show up in the research. And the only time Satan has shown
maybe
up
that's
is,
good.
Well, Michael Newton reported a case where a minister saw Satan in his between-life session, and he was frightened, and he started crying, and he said, you know, he's standing right here, breathing fire, he's got horns on his head. And Newton, who had, you know, done so many cases, said, well, what's he dressed like? What's he wearing on his feet? And the guy said, well, he's wearing tennis shoes. And Newton said, well, that doesn't sound like very scary. And in that moment, he realized his spirit guide, this minister's spirit guide, had put on a guise, a mask of Satan to scare him, to show him what it was like that he had been doing his whole life, scaring people to gain power from them. And in that moment, he was ashamed because he realized that was accurate, that he had been doing that. So the concept of evil is used by people to judge others. But my point is, when you do this research, you see it's so hard to if you're opening your heart to everyone, It's very hard to judge a person's actions unless you're in their shoes, or you're in the shoes of one of their soul group. So you could ask them, like, why did this person behave this way? And it's really up to them and their guides to understand what their journey is. Now, certainly, you want to protect yourself from people that are crazy, protect yourself from people who are, you know, who have ill intent. But at the same time, if you have that concept, you know, like they do in Denmark and Finland, you know, where life career criminals are taught how to be different. In Holland, they're doing past life reviews with career criminals. They're doing it as part of a state program to, you know, people examine the reasons they became dark, they, you know, including a past life. It allows them to change as opposed to just tossing them away.
Mm-hmm. Let's go to Dan in Dubuque, Iowa, east of the Rockies. Dan, you're on the air with us. Go ahead.
Thanks, George. I appreciate it. I wanted to ask your guest if he'd ever heard of pre-birth memories. I have, like, a lot of pre-birth memories. And I wondered if he had done any research into that.
Pre-birth memories. What do you think, Rich?
Absolutely. And in every case where someone does a between-life session, that is included. So the hypnotherapist will ask you to remember your earliest memory in this lifetime. And then they'll say, let's go to prior to that. They'll ask you, when did you enter the womb? Which you would think that people would say, how could I know the answer to that question? But people do answer. And Michael Newton's research showed that it was about the fourth month in general. People would show up for conception, but not enter, just sort of hang out until it was time to enter into the fetus. This is just the report. And so ultimately, pre-birth memories, consciousness prior to birth, I've seen it at least 25 times. I've experienced it myself. Hypnotherapist saying, so why did you choose your mother? And what's it like here? And I was there experiencing my mother playing the piano, you know, before I was born, and talking about why I chose my parents. And then actually experiencing being born and seeing the doctor's face in that weird metal platen they used to have, you know, that reflector back in the 50s, you know, when I was born.
How old were you during your youngest memory? I was a year and a half old.
A year and a half. What was your memory? What did you remember?
I remember my mother going to the hospital in January to deliver my sister. And nobody believed me until I told her what kind of color coat she was wearing. She couldn't believe it.
And and it was prior to you knowing language.
I didn't know language, and what's funny, Rich, is that the memory I have of it with that little brain of mine was the same feeling that I still have now. I mean, I had that identity with self.
Exactly.
And it was weird.
It's an example of consciousness. So your consciousness isn't any different than when it showed up to George as it is now. It hasn't gotten that much older, you see. You've learned a lot of stuff, but your consciousness isn't any different. In my case, the hypnotherapist said, go to your first memory. And I saw myself coming out into the world.
Well, we're going to come back into your world in just a moment and take some final phone calls and wrap things up on Coast to Coast AM. Well, we've got posted at coasttocoastam.com under the highlights my August events, Edinburgh, Texas, and Toronto, Canada. So go ahead and come on out and see us, and we're going to have a great time doing that. On our next Coast to Coast program, a couple guests for the first couple hours. Dr. Joel Wallach joins us from criticalhealthnews.com, and then Lisa Barnett talks about the Akashic Records. So a full slate for you on Coast to Coast AM. Welcome back to Coast, Rich Martini with us. Our final segment, his websites are linked up for you at coasttocoastam.com. Let's go to Mike in Las Vegas, Nevada. Hey, Mike, you're on the air with us. Go ahead.
George. It's been many years, my friend.
Thank you.
So, Rich, your timing cannot be better for me. There's a woman that I met. I'm 43 years old. And the moment she met me, she said, I feel like I know you. And it's been very confusing since then. We're very much in love, but neither one of us can figure out why. And hearing you speak, it all makes more sense than anything I've ever heard before.
Well, that's great, man.
Where's the magic here, Rich? What do you
think? Yeah, there's magic there, man. You know, and what a wonderful thing to meet anybody on the planet that you actually connect to. It's the goofiest thing. We're here, and a lot of times people don't meet people, and they go through their whole life, and then they realize, oh, my God, it's the person I met back when I was 5. That was the connection. I mean, it's wonderful. You know, we do spend a lot of time trying to figure out why things are happening or how they're happening. You know, part of me just wants to say, dude, you're on stage. You know, enjoy the moment. The idea that you feel like you've known each other before, that's fantastic. And it's difficult because people aren't always, you know, sometimes they might agree to meet up at some point. Let's meet in Vegas. And then at some point it's not going to work out because, you know, the ex-husband shows up or, you know, the other thing shows up. And that's okay too, just like on a stage, just like in a play. But my feeling is honor the moment. That wonderful thing of feeling that connection and explore it. Like, what does this mean? You know, what do you remember? You know, explore it as best you can. I mean, the affairs of the heart are very strange and very unusual, but, you know, when you honor them by acknowledging that they exist.
Rich, is it safe to say that all people that we are close to in our physical life, close to, we had some kind of relationship with in past lives?
Well, I mean, that would kind of make sense, but it, you know, in the research, it, you know, it depends on you. Are you a person who likes to go out and explore new things? Some people get disconcerted when you talk about a soul group. You know, Newton says there's an average of 15 in everybody's soul group, and it's anywhere from 3 to 25. And I've explored many, many different soul groups with different people. But if you call it a soul group, it feels like it's inclusive. But the truth is, it's like a classroom in a university. So as soon as the class is over, you move on to other classes, and you meet other people all across campus. So it's not like we don't connect with people all over the place. He calls them affiliated groups, but, you know, maybe that's too strong of a term. We're always connecting with people in different realms, in different places, in different areas, but we have a core group that kind of we work on things on a topic or a premise, and all of us kind of work on the same premise. And the premise might be, I'll give you one example. Someone told me that their soul group worked on the energy of excess. And that, you know, was some one person tried a lifetime where there was obesity involved, another one tried, you know, drugs and et cetera, et cetera. I'd never heard that term, the energy of excess. But you can imagine what that means. And the soul group are all kind of working on that and learning from it. And eventually you graduate from your soul group. You might move into another group, you see? So it's more convenient to think of it as a classroom. And sure, there's a lot of people in your life that you feel close to, your kids, etc., that, you know, that may very well be part of that group. But there's a lot who may not be. It depends on you.
Let's go out to Mary now in Ohio. Hi, Mary. Go ahead.
Hi, Mary.
Hello, George. Thank you for taking my call, and Dave,
sure,
Paul Screener, for getting me in there. It's amazing that Rich just mentioned school and the soul groups and everything. My sister passed away in 2004 of a brain tumor, and her children were young at the time, and her husband had said to the kids, she's done with Earth school, she's moved on. And I thought that was a good thing to say to them, you know, since they were young. But anyways, that's not what I called about. What I'm calling about is I'm a Catholic, and being a Catholic, when people die, you pray for the dead. And I've never really understood that, why we pray for the dead, because they're where they're supposed to be. They've moved on, and they're in heaven, and why do we pray for the dead? And I have a very good friend who's a nun, and I asked her, my husband passed away from a heart attack in 2012. And I asked the nun at that time, I was crying and I was very upset, and I was talking to her, and I said, I don't understand why we pray for the dead. And she gave me the traditional response, well, Mary, you know, I know you have a very deep faith and you understand where your husband is, and we pray for the dead because we want them to move on and, you know, help them. And after my husband died, a young lady came to the wake that was able to see spirits. And I took her into the other room, and I had a conversation with her, and I knew my husband was there. And then recently, just, you know, 2-3 weeks ago, I ran into the same young lady, and she said, "Your husband's here." And I said, "Oh." I said, "Okay." And so I asked him. I said, "Hey, I pray for you all the time. Does that help you?" And he laughed, and he said, "No, it helps you."
Brilliant. That's very good.
And I didn't understand that. I don't understand that. And then the situation, I wasn't able to ask her anything further, but that's what my husband communicated to me, was that, no, it doesn't help me, it helps you.
Well, you know, think of it in terms of the comedy of that. He's really trying to say to you, "I'm okay. There's no pain over here. I'm fine." So when you're asking me, you know, specifically, is that prayer help you move on? And he's just answering your question, which is, no, actually, because I'm okay over here. It's helping you to process that I'm not there with you. Don't forget, he's gone home. You're still here in the drama of, you know, the journey that we're on. So it's a wonderful thing to experience, of having him be so direct. I know it's disconcerting, but ultimately you sort of have to see that, look, all religions try to do this thing of try to explain the afterlife or explain life. They all do. And, you know, I grew up Catholic as well, so I understand their point of view. But ultimately, once I had done this research, I realized, wow, everything that Jesus said, now as I look at what he says, I see he's talking about the flip side. He's talking about the kingdom of heaven, meaning, you know, that place where we all go. We're all equal back there. Everyone's equal. There's no one higher or lower. There's, you know, the people that are super rich, you know, they might have a hard time losing all of their possessions. But ultimately, we're back there. Your possession is love. That's the thing that you have. That's the thing that connects us to each other. The idea of love your neighbor as yourself, that's pervasive throughout the universe. So it is kind of funny that, you know, that your husband would say, "I'm okay." That's really what he's saying. And prayer is helpful for you. But of course, you know, like I was saying at the top of the show, you know, if you talk to a photograph out loud and allow that you don't know the answer to what you're asking, you may actually get an answer. And in this case, it came from a medium.
Rich, you've done a lot of work in Tibet, so I have to assume you have read the Tibetan Book of the Dead.
I have. In fact, I worked with Robert Thurman, who wrote a translation of the Tibetan Book of the Dead, and we've had this great conversation about it. I'm also friends with a guy here in Los Angeles who does a lot of translation, Peter Roberts, of Tibetan books. Here's the thing. The Tibetan Book of the Dead was originally written and experienced by one monk in about the 8th century. And for about 200 or 300 years, it was then passed along orally, what they call a secret tradition. Mm-hmm. Mistranslation, it just means an oral tradition. They passed it along from monk to monk because they didn't want people to know what they were talking about, so it was passed along as an oral tradition. And eventually, it was written, and since then, there's been thousands of essays by different monks about the Tibetan Book of the Dead. It's accurate in terms of the research about the process of dissolution of senses, et cetera, et cetera. But when it gets to the fundamental thing of what happens between lives, you know, this bardo concept, the Tibetan Book of the Dead says that consciousness is a wisp of smoke, which is what it called a clear light. It's very subtle, they call it. And that's not what's in the research. What's in the research is that consciousness between lives, we're fully aware of all of our lifetimes, and we choose who we're going to be in our next lifetime. In the Tibetan Book of the Dead, it says we kind of wander around like the smoke until we run into somebody literally having sex, and we decide, oh, that's where we want to be, and depending how we've acted in a previous lifetime, we get a lesser life or a higher life, etc., etc. As I said to a Tibetan monk who's a friend of mine, who said to me, "Are you kidding? Why would I choose to be born in Africa, HIV positive, to an impoverished family?" And I said, "Well, which one of those is a negative thing? First of all, you find in this research that the people who choose difficult lives our older, wiser souls.
Mm-hmm.
So there is no lesser life. There only is the magic of life. And if you choose to have a difficult lifetime, wow, I honor you for making that difficult choice. So I'm just saying, in the data, in the research, it's not accurate what the Tibetan Book of the Dead says. In terms of everything else that Tibetan philosophy says, and I've read it and studied it and been there, I think it's absolutely accurate about the nature of reality and who we are as people. But when it comes to this one particular detail, as I said to Bob Thurman, Michael Newton had 7,000 cases before he published his book. This is one case that has been talked about thousands of times, as opposed to literally two monks having the same experience. And if you find two monks having the exact same experience, then you can examine it, you see? Like near-death experiences. There's been hundreds of thousands of them. So you can really examine what the journey is.
I'm waiting for the punchline, too, when you were saying two monks, you know.
Two monks going to a bar.
Yeah,
they
exactly.
Find a Catholic in there. They go, what's the meaning of life? And they go, Rich Martini, talk to him.
Perry in Santa Barbara, California. Hi, Perry. Go ahead.
I thank you so much, George, and hi, Rich. Wonderful program tonight. About the dreaming of my lost loved ones, friends and family members, mm-hmm. How can you tell if it's a dream? Because, you know, when I'm dreaming these, you know, I know they're all, you're gone, but it seems like what the impression I get in dreaming about these people is life is eternal and death does not exist.
Right. That's fantastic. Well, are you asking in terms of, like, how can you tell the difference between a dream, a real dream, and, like, something that might be planted from a loved one?
Yeah, because sometimes, you know, within the dreams of my deceased loved ones, sometimes, you know, my mom would be there. She's still physically alive, you know, or my dad. And mm-hmm. I just wanted to know how do you just differentiate that, you know?
Yeah. Well, I'll tell you, Newton was the first person who turned me on to it because in his books, he asked people, like, how do you do that? You know, the people would say, well, I, you know, after that previous lifetime where I died, I came back and helped my loved one. And he asked, how do you do that? And frequently people would say, well, the experience, it's very difficult because, of course, people are grieving and their emotion is out of kilter. But what I would do is I'd wait for a moment where I could actually enter a dream and deposit sort of like an energetic pattern of myself in a familiar setting, so it wouldn't scare them, wouldn't make them disconcerted. Like at the top of the show when I said my cousin, you know, had her son appear in a dream. If he had just appeared out of nowhere, it would have been disconcerting to her. But because he appeared in this party setting, she was already happy to see all of her loved ones. So the idea of them, your loved ones, creating an environment so that they can inject themselves to pass along a message. And that's when it gets really interesting, because when you examine the dream later on, you want to say, okay, what happened? What did they say to me? And then in the case of my cousin, her son said to her, look at the pictures. And of course she walked away from that thinking, well, whatever that means. But he meant literally, take out a picture of your loved one. Imagine that person present, in the present tense, and speak to them in the present tense, because they aren't gone. They're just not here. So that idea of imagining how difficult it must be for them to try to communicate with you. I had one case with this television producer, a friend of mine, Howard Schultz, who passed away recently. But he did a session with Between Life, and he said, he was talking to his mother, and his mother said, imagine picking up a cell phone and pushing buttons, and then you connect to your loved one. She said, it's the same thing here. We hear your messages, and we try to reply however we can. So in your case, it may be that the best way for them to reply is through a dream.
Let's go to Chad, first-time caller, Tampa, Florida. Hi, Chad. Thank you.
Hi, Chad.
Hi, how are we doing tonight?
Good.
Excellent. I have a kind of a weird story about unfortunate timing with your soulmate, I guess. I was got off work one night. I walked into a bar, and as I was walking in, there's these two girls outside talking, and they're like, you know, they said something that kind of caught my attention. I looked over, like, oh no, not you, not you, not you. I was like, oh, okay, that's fine. Of course, being kind of cute, I decided to go over and introduce myself to them. Introduce myself to the first one. She's like, oh, hi, I'm Aaron. And I go to the second one. I'm like, wait a minute, I know you. And she's like, oh, I don't think so. I'm like, no. Your name is Tamara. And her face just goes completely white, like ghost white. And she's like, that's not what I go by, but that's my legal name. I'm like,
How did you know that?
I don't know. It just, like, popped in my head. It's not like I walk around the bars and say, hey, is your name Tamara? No, that's not my style.
We only got a minute left, Rich. Go ahead.
Did you connect up with Tamara? Was that something that worked out?
What's unfortunate about it is I go inside, tell my buddy about it, about how I met this girl, and he's like, you know, that's never going to happen again. I'm like, you're right. Hang on one second. I'll be right back. So I go up to her, I'm like, I need to know, are you single? She's like, I got engaged last week.
Oh. All right, so very good. It happens that way. But you know what? You have to honor the fact that you were able to connect to someone on a level that's not of this planet. You were able to connect to her and hear her name without thinking about it. So now I just want you to focus on lottery numbers. And tell me, if you know them, I'd like to know what they are.
Get them indeed.
Get them.
Hey, Rich, once again, thank you. You're always a delight, my friend.
Thank you, George. It's a treat to talk to you, and I can't wait to see you again.
All right. Rich Martini, of course, the website's all linked up for you at coasttocoastam.com. Great guy. Don't forget to like us on Facebook. Follow us on Twitter by going to coasttocoastam.com. For Dan Galante, Dave Hines, Tom Danheiser, Lisa Lyon, Lex Lonehood, Sean Lautasaur, Stephanie Smith, Chris Morrison, George Knapp. I'm George Norrie, somewhere out there on Coast to Coast AM. We'll see you on our next edition. Until then, be safe, everyone.